So here is the first installment of the actual Bible study on Genesis. First of all, read Genesis 1 in several different versions. And if you haven't read or listened to my post on translations, you might want to do that first. If you don't have hard copy of different translations, you can find online versions. And I suggest some of those on the written part of this. I particularly suggest that you read the New Revised Standard Version, which is the NRSV, the New International Version, or the NIV, the Common English Bible, that's the CEB, and that's really brand new, and the New Jerusalem Bible, or the NJB. And if you can find a copy of the Jewish Publication Society English translation of the Hebrew Bible, otherwise called the Tanakh, then that would be really worthwhile to read as well. So Genesis actually contains two versions of the creation story. The first is found in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 through Genesis chapter 2, verse 4a. In historical critical terms, it's from the priestly tradition. And in some ways, it's similar to the Babylonian creation story called the Enuma Elish. However, there are also some major differences in the two stories. In the Enuma Elish, creation happens through conflict and violence and through tearing apart the bodies of divine beings, whereas in the Genesis story, creation takes place through the spoken word of God. What I think is really amazing about Genesis 1 is that it was probably written while the Israelites were in exile in Babylon, and they went into exile about 587 BC. They were there and they were watching the yearly festivals of the powerful Babylonians celebrating the Babylonian creation myths. And yet, even though they're this small group of people that's been overcome by the Babylonians, they had the audacity and faith to say, our God is not just more powerful than your God, our God is the only God and the creator of the whole universe. Now, most people in that situation would have said their God lost the battle, just like they as a people had lost a battle. But the Israelites said, our God is the only God. We can't even begin to imagine the boldness of that claim today. But whoever wrote down this story of creation had an amazing faith. In Genesis 1, since it's from the priestly tradition, there's this concern with order. But it begins with this line that I talked about in my sermon, when God began to create the heavens and the earth. In the traditional version, the King James Version, it says, in the beginning God created. And that gives the sense that God created a long time ago and then just kind of quit. If we read it when God began to create, then we get the sense that God is continuing to create, that God is still concerned with creation. And I think that's a more appropriate way to translate it and a more appropriate theological view. In verse 2, you have these images of chaos and confusion and emptiness and waste, formless void and darkness. You see the same kind of images in places like Isaiah 34:11 or Isaiah 40:17. Also, you see it in Jeremiah 4:23, where it says the earth was chaos and confusion. And that wind from God that's sweeping over the face of the waters isn't so much a spirit hovering as a god-awful wind blowing the waters around. The image is really that maybe of a hurricane. It's chaotic. The darkness is that same darkness that comes upon the land of Egypt during the last plague. And it's also the darkness of chaos that only the light of God can overcome. And you might look at Psalm 18:28, it is you who light my lamp, the Lord my God lights up my darkness. In Genesis 1:3, we see that God speaks a word into this chaos, let there be light, and there was light. The creating force is the word of God. And really, the next few verses are full of the action of God. God speaks, God sees, God separates, God calls. You see the same kind of thing, the creation through the word of God. By the way, if you look at John, the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, that's modeled on this creation story, and it talks about the creating word of God. In Genesis 2, we'll see that the man is acting in the image of God, as he is the one who calls each animal by name. Here, God calls each part of creation by name. God creates the light and then names the light, creates the darkness and then names the darkness. And note in verse 4, God sees that creation is good. You have this refrain that repeats over and over. God sees what God has done, and God calls it good. And the word for good in Hebrew, tov, doesn't just mean good as in moral good, but it means right, appropriate, fortunate, agreeable. God's saying, wow, I did a good job. How cool is that? In a way, creation is also redemption. God is saving the world from chaos in this ordering and separating and naming that God does. Now, the Hebrew view of the world, or sort of cosmology, is seen in verse 6 and 7 and 8. If you look at the picture on the website, you'll see that the ancient Near Eastern peoples had this view of the world that there literally were waters above and waters below. And when it says that God put a dome in the midst, well, that's exactly what they thought of, that there was a dome and up there were waters and underneath were waters, and the earth rests on these pillars that, in fact, the sea monsters might run into them and shake them and cause the earthquakes. This is a view that's reflected in the creation text in Genesis and elsewhere in the Bible, and it doesn't make the stories wrong or untrue. It just means that God spoke the language of the people to whom the stories were first given. The particular cosmology isn't the point of the story, however, and we shouldn't get too caught up in it. The text transcends the cosmology. In the first 3 days, God's made the basic structure of earth and heaven. We now have earth, water, and light, and dark, and food. And finally, God sets up the seasons. You might say God here is creating time. That happens in, in verse 14, where God says, let the lights be in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons. Other ancient Near Eastern peoples either worshipped the lights in the sky or saw them as homes for divine beings. And here, they're not even named. These aren't homes for divine beings. These are just another part of God's creation. So they're not really even named. They're just called the greater light and the lesser light. Once God is happy with the basic structure, then God moves on to life of greater complexity. God makes swarming things and great sea monsters. And I think that word about the sea monsters is a way of reassuring people who were really kind of nervous about the sea that even the monsters of the deep, which some worshipped as gods, were simply another part of God's creation, and they were not to be feared. Now, when we move on to Genesis 1:26, that's where things get really interesting. It says that God spoke a word, let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the cattle and the wild things of the earth and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in God's image, and in the image of God he created them, male and female he created them. And then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion. What's interesting about these particular verses is that we see that God has been creating each thing after its kind. And in a sense, humanity is created after its kind in the image of God. A lot of people ask, why is it that God says, let us make humankind in our image? And there's four answers that we can potentially give. One is that it could be the royal we. God is speaking as the great ruler or creator. Or secondly, God could be speaking to the divine court. We see the divine court in books like Job and Isaiah, where where there are other divine beings and God is speaking to them. From a Christian point of view, we could say that God is speaking as the Trinity, but that is a Christian point of view that would then be imported back into the text. I think the one that's most likely and most faithful to the text as it stands is that when God creates human beings, God is creating as a relational God. And even if you don't think that the Hebrew text is explicitly talking about the Trinity, God still seems to be speaking as one whose nature is relational. And therefore, when God creates humans, God creates them as a relationship, male and female. Both are in the image of God, and maybe even both are needed for the image of God. And then once God has created humans, God gives them this command, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion. So let's think for a moment what it means to be made in the image of God. Well, first of all, I think it means that we're made in relationship and for relationship. Men and women are created at the same time because that is an important part of what it means to be in the image of God. Also, this command that God gives them, be fruitful and multiply. The fruitfulness is something that comes out of who God is. God is a fruitful God. God creates, and we too are to be creative in our own way. Now, certainly in Genesis and in the Old Testament, being fruitful did mean first tilling the land, keeping the land, and having the land be fruitful, and then for women, of course, bearing children. But later on, I think when Paul is talking about the fruits of the Spirit, he's talking about a new way to be fruitful, and that we should think of it in those terms. God says to fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it, and those are strong words, that sense of subdue. I think that gives us a sense, even in Genesis 1, that it's not going to be easy to take care of the earth and to bring fruitfulness out of the earth. When God has made human beings, God looks and says, wow, it's very good. And that's the sixth day. Now, we often think of humankind as sort of the pinnacle of creation, but really, it's not humankind that's the pinnacle of creation, it's the Sabbath. Because on the seventh day, as we get to chapter 2, God finishes the work or brings some kind of completion to the work that God has done and rests. And so that seventh day is blessed and hallowed because God is looking at all the work that God has done in creation. And I think the sense here is that God is exulting, is enjoying the creation. Now, I wonder sometimes if maybe there's a sense in which we're still in the sixth day. Maybe God hasn't finished creation and that it won't be until God has created the new heavens and the earth that this part of creation that is really finished and that God will really be able to rest. But in any case, that's the first creation story. Genesis chapter 1.